You're listening to WRHU's coverage of the Belmont Stakes, the third race in the Triple Crown and the biggest race and home of some of the most memorable events in horse racing history.
Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish 25 lengths in front.
Now let's go live and on-site to our reporters at Belmont.
To beautiful Belmont Park for our special covering the Belmont Stakes. I'm David Blixova, joined here by Dr. Greg Barroza once again, the horse doc himself, talking horses with you here this morning. We just got off with Carlos Martin, who was kind enough to give us some of his time on a busy morning as a trainer. Dr. Barroza, your takes from the Carlos Martin interview.
Well, you know, we were very fortunate to get Carlos to come so early. For the people that don't understand the race world, these trainers, as of right this moment, are out there bringing their horses out. You might hear them in the background over our voices a little bit here and there. They're galloping by as they're exercising for races either later today or for tomorrow or Saturday or whatever day. But the show goes on. And it's a little bit of an overcast day here, etc. A little bit of light rain, just so everyone knows. So it's not a glorious environment, but it was warm and charming to get Carlos in here, and he does have truly an insider's view of the race world coming from the storied Martin family. Again, his grandfather was kind of a boisterous guy. I did get to work with him, and he ended up bringing Sham. And as we know from, you know, boxing, Muhammad Ali became a great boxer, but he also had George Foreman, and he had Smoke and Joe Frazier that pushed him along the way. And what you're going to see on Saturday is the best horse is going to win, but it's not just because of the instinct of the horse to win, but it's also because he hears the other two horses or three horses coming around him and coming up. He's going to give it his all to see if he can be the one to win. So that horse, Sham, did an amazing job and goes down in history as one of the greatest of all time. People don't remember that only because he came in second each time, but still wonderful. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be back and at least have a little bit more of a normal semblance to life at the track, and things are looking better than they did a year ago, and it's a pleasure being here with David and with Mike. So you got any comments about the day and how things are shaping up?
As I say, you mentioned just how enjoyable it is to be back at the track. We talked about it with Carlos. Naira is expecting 11,000 to 12,000 fans approximately in attendance, which I know it doesn't sound like a lot when you look at it over the years, but last year when there was zero, I think that will be a lot, and I think it will be a nice change for the jockeys, for the trainers, to hear the fans, to hear the bettors. And for the horses, you think about it, these horses are all 3 years old. So they started racing last spring in their two-year-old season. By then, most of the world was shut down, and any tracks that were operating empty. So the Kentucky Derby, for the horses that ran the Kentucky Derby, that was their first time really hearing the crowd noise as the horses turn for home in that final quarter of a mile of run. And I think it'll be really interesting today, too, to hear, to see how the horses react, if any way, to the crowd noise.
Yep. And, you know, it's just so the fans understand, we're expecting to get, you know, a true handicapper. And a true handicapper, he's supposed to come into the show later today. And it's kind of an open mic today. But the fellow who's supposed to handicap, Dave Grunning, is nationally known, internationally known. He knows how to rate horses based upon performance in a race, based upon how they've done in previous battles, based upon their breeding, based upon the training, based upon the sequence between the last race and the next race. And sometimes there's some QT on the side about which horse had to get laid up and given a breather after a race, just like happens with a Nixon, someone pulling an Achilles and things like this. There are minor injuries that occur in this sport and reasons to lay these horses up and wait for the next round. But I wanted to, I'm going to challenge David here, and he will not know the answer to this. If he knows the answer, the next beer is on me. So I'm only doing it not to embarrass him, because I would have no idea if I didn't have a cheat sheet next to me. But one thing that I was always surprised about is that the position in the gate, what position you get, is often of tremendous advantage. And why that is, I don't know. I studied it a little bit for the Derby, where they've got 20 horses in the gate. And generally, the horse that's on the inside gets trapped in and can't get out and has a bad go unless they can get out. the horses more in the middle of the pack have a better shot. But there's actually statistics on which is the best spot to be for the Belmont. Would you happen to know what that is?
I want to say it's probably around the middle of the pack, probably the four or the five post.
Right. And just so you're not totally embarrassed, I would have said the same thing. But the best spot is the worst spot for the Derby. It's the number one post. So for whatever reason, someone did an analysis. I don't know how many years this is, but I'm looking here. There are 24 times that the horse won the Belmont out of number one. And then the second one is around five. Now, for the Belmont, generally, we get about 10 horses, something like that. So it's a little bit smaller than the Derby. So it's spread out a little bit. Generally, anything on the outside post, any horse on the outside post doesn't do well. Although I do believe, and I'm not a statistician, I don't have that great a recall memory, but we were fortunate. I think it was 2017. We did this show at Belmont Park, and there was a fellow who was walking along the rails, and he was dressed in kind of ragged jeans, and he didn't look like anyone other than just someone maybe just hanging out. But I recognized him, and we were down, and I invited him over to the table, and I said he was a trainer, and I said, "Would you mind giving us an interview?" And I didn't really know him very well. His name was Steve, and I said, "Steve, would you give us the interview?" And he said, "Yeah, sure." So he sat down. He said, "I don't have any other horses here but the horse in the Belmont," and that was Creator, and he won that year. And he came from the outside post. He came from so far out of the odds, it was incredible. And he bulleted through and came up from the rear and beat everyone to all the fans' amazement. So he defied the odds of an outside post, and he defied the odds of not only being in the outside post but also having terrible odds and doing so well. And he won that day, so it brought him good luck by being here. But
and I'll touch on my inside post theory, my two cents as an opinion. But first, I remember Creator, because I remember watching that race at home and how tight that finish was with, I believe it was Todd Pletcher's horse Destin on the inside. And I remember afterwards, I had a lot of people who were not big racing fans know, ask me, how did Irad know he won that race? Because if you remember, Irad was practically standing straight up in his saddle after he won. And the photo came back. It was less than a nose. And it made me think, these jockeys are professionals. They've been riding for so long. They know where the wire is. They know exactly when to move their horses. And it shows that day that Irad, you know, he probably would have liked to have won by more than a nose. But a win's a win, especially in a Triple Crown race. But jockeys have a great sense of time, pace, and control when it comes to riding races. And that goes into my theory about why the inside is so valuable. At a track like this, at Belmont Park, there's not a whole lot of time to get into that first turn compared to the Kentucky Derby, compared to other tracks. You are starting on the finish line, so the outside is not advantageous unless you're taking your horse all the way back or you're going to the lead. If you're in the one post, you almost have to always go to the lead. But this track, especially in the Belmont Stakes, we see it favors horses that lay closer to the lead than horses that come from far behind statistically over the years. Think about it. American Pharoah won on the lead. Justify won on the lead. A lot of horses that win this race are closer to the lead. Can horses come from farther behind? Of course. But in the one post on the inside, you want to be on the lead. You got to get out of that gate and get closer to the lead.
Well, I think you're right about that. And to add further comments, I mean, based on what Carlos said, you know, these horses are being bred more and more for speed because the races are shorter. It used to be fairly common to have mile and a half races. They've even had mile and three quarter. They even had, at one point, I think, a 2 mile race. They don't do that anymore. But now it's shorter and shorter distances. They're bred for speed, and they don't necessarily have the stamina to stay in there. So what Carlos is saying, just because of their sheer pedigree and their sheer determination to win, they might hang on that extra eighth of a mile and push themselves to win that race. So I would tend to agree with you that especially in a mile and a half race, you can only push so hard and for so long. And then a horse coming from behind is a rare thing in a mile and a half race. It's very rare because by then everyone is spent. They don't have much left in the tank, much gas left in the tank.
And you mentioned how there's so few mile and a half races on dirt. I will clarify, you see it more on turf races. The horses can run a little bit longer because it's not as hard on them to run on grass than it is on dirt. But I think this is the first time that we're going to see the Brooklyn Handicap, which is on the undercard of the Belmont Stakes, run at the same day. And the Brooklyn is also a mile and a half race. So I'll be very interested to see the horse that wins the Brooklyn, which I just looked at the fourth race this Saturday, if that horse is on the lead, second, third, what position that horse, the eventual winner, is, and how that will affect strategy for the trainers and jockeys later in the Belmont going the same distance.
Hard to say. Hard to say. You know, it's interesting. All the handicappers get together and they come up with all these charts and these theories and these formulas. Maybe today we need an algorithm or something to, like they do with the stock market, where someone could figure out everything, plug it in. And I'm sure there's someone in professional betting circles that does stuff like that and come up with an answer. But every so often, someone will walk on the track that knows nothing about it, and they just like the name of the horse, they bet on it, and they win.
You know, I've seen it over the years. Friends of mine, they pick names, they pick numbers. I try to do the whole algorithm, as you mentioned, study the statistics, look at the horse's last race, and sometimes my horse finishes last and their horse finishes first. So for the fans, I think they'll enjoy it. And that's the other thing about betting on the big days, is you get a lot of people that'll just bet names or they'll bet numbers, and sometimes it influences the odds, either negatively or positively. And that's why you get a nice priced horse sometimes winning the Belmont Stakes, where you look any other day, that horse would have been the favorite.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, we are going to take another break here this morning at Belmont Park. I'm David Blixover with Dr. Greg Barroza. Still plenty more to talk about on beautiful Belmont Park undercard weekend.
You're listening to WRHU's coverage of the Belmont Stakes. Now let's go live and on-site to our reporters at Belmont.
Can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do.
Belmont Park for our coverage of the Belmont Stakes. Once again, I'm David Blixover, joined by Dr. Greg Barroza, a.k.a. the horse doc himself, talking horses with you on an overcast Thursday morning here in Elmont. In just a few moments, we will have Daily Racing Form handicapper David Grenning joining us. But in the meantime, Dr. Barroza, we're shifting gears a little bit. We had Carlos Martin, who's a trainer based in New York, on earlier in the hour. We talked a little bit about how the fans are coming back to the track. We talked a little bit about how post position affects it from a handicapper's perspective. We'll hear it from a expert in just a moment. What else have you noticed that's different this year, especially from last year, but even from 2 years ago when we were last here?
What have I noticed different? Not a whole lot. I hate to surprise you. It's really the same place. It's the same world that I've known. But the only thing that's different is every year the names change. The stories behind each one of those names changes. There's always a new story. It's like watching a new movie. And every year there's some new excitement about it. And there's always some story. And we're going to talk a lot in the next hour or two about all these things. But we are going to speak with David Grenning, who's going to give us his opinion of who he thinks is going to win the race or has the best chances. No one really knows, honestly. And I think that that's the excitement of being here, is to try to figure out who and why and to listen to the story. So before David gets here and before we hear all these other people comment, we should ask Carlos, but who do you pick for the race, David?
But, looking at it, I think the race, it's from a perspective of betting, it's a wide open race. If you're looking for a horse with value, I'm looking at Hot Rod Charlie. I think his race in the Kentucky Derby was really competitive. There's something to be said. I know Carlos touched on it. There's something to be said for Flavian Pratt jumping off the horse he won the Preakness on 3 weeks ago and coming back to the horse he finished third, maybe second in the Kentucky Derby, depending on what Churchill Downs decides to do. That is my pick right now. Doug O'Neill's been here before. He knows how to win Triple Crown races. That's not to overlook the favorite in essential quality. The horse had its first loss of its career in the Kentucky Derby, which is not something that you can be too discouraged by. I mean, he did run against 20 horses. So if I had to pick, looking at value, looking at a horse I think is going to be competitive, I'm looking at Hot Rod Charlie.
Okay, well, interesting. I'll use the opportunity to give you my thoughts right now, and they could change. Anything could change. Some of the horses, they seem to peak at a certain time, and you could have a horse that's got a 4 or 5 race winning streak, and then all of a sudden they start to tail off because these trainers ask so much of these horses, especially in these big races. The big races aren't like your standard go out and come home and with a small trophy. This is like they give maximum effort, and they're pushed to do that. Having said that, some of them, the value in some of the trainers is knowing when to push your horse for that final gear in the big races. If you do it too soon into their career, you burn them out. If you wait too late, you lost the opportunity. And also, some of the trainers have to be smart enough to know when they've squeezed as much as they could squeeze out of that horse and say it's time to put them on the shelf for 4 months, 6 months, keep them in some light training and bring them back for a bigger race like the Travers in Saratoga or something like that. And so for that reason, I don't think Essential Quality is going to win, but he is the favorite horse. He's the betting odds favorite, and that's a horse that had a 5-win race streak until he came to the Derby, and then he came in fourth against the best horses in the country. Also remember that many of these great horses, this is one of those races where they all meet up together. Before that, oftentimes there might be one or two super horses in a field of 6, 8, 10 horses, so they're only really competing against two or three horses. They're all, in this case, and I think that's the beauty of Saturday, that out of the 8 horses, at least 6 of them, I could easily say that there's, you know, I should have known better. They had a good shot of winning, and they did win. So that can happen. So for that reason, I'm kind of not putting Essential Quality first in my own mind. Rumbauer, super, super in the Preakness, and was coming on strong at the end. So a lot of people think that he's got a lot of speed and he's got a lot of endurance yet, and this is a longer race and he'll hold to it. I don't know about that. I think he's a super horse. I think any of these horses I mentioned, by the way, I think are all going to be in the top 4. That's why I'm mentioning them. But I don't think he's going to win it. And I happen to agree with you. I wish I didn't, only because then we could have a little ongoing ongoing thing going here. So.
Well, I do think as good as Hot Rod Charlie is, you can't overlook the local boy in Todd Pletcher. And he's got 3 horses in here. The one I think is best shot of winning is the one with the lowest odds, and Known Agenda, who did have the dreaded one post in the Kentucky Derby, and he finished 9th out of it. He takes the extra gap, skipped the Preakness, he comes back fresh in the Belmont. Pletcher knows how to get a horse ready, so I think between him and Hot Rod Charlie, that'll be my exacta. And just now, we are being joined by Daily Racing Form handicapper David Grenning. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, guys.
What are you looking for as you hold the Bible, as horse players call it? What are you looking at in this year's Belmont Stakes versus years past, if anything's different?
Well, I don't know that anything's – well, at least we're different from last year when it was 1.8 miles. I'm glad to see that we're back to 1.5 miles. You kind of look at this race as you look at any race in terms of where's the pace going to come from. How talented is the pace? Is it cheap speed? Is it legitimate a pace horse? And in this particular year, it seems like we have a legitimate front-running types or horses who'd like to be in the mix early, starting with Rock Your World, who won the San Anita Derby on the front end in his first ever start on dirt. He was eliminated at the break in the Kentucky Derby. But they also go a lot faster in the Derby at 1.25 miles than they do here at 1.5 miles. The pace will be 48 for a 1/2 mile. That might even be considered fast. And you're going to see horses maybe because of the slower pace a little bit closer than they normally would be. And maybe it takes them out of their game, some of those stone-cold closers like a Bourbonic or I wouldn't say Rumbauer's a stone-cold closer. I think you'll see a lot of these horses, it'll be a tight pack going into the first turn, I think. But I think with Rock Your World has some speed, he's going to want to go. Hot Rod Charlie, I don't think he'll be too far off of it. You know, one of the things that people didn't talk too much about in the Kentucky Derby was coming under the wire the first time, Hot Rod Charlie was in between horses, and it could have gotten a little hairy in there. And he got through that and then got a forward position and then sort of ran his race, but just came up a bit short. I think if he didn't have that, I don't want to say trouble, that early little traffic, I guess, he might have been sitting second where Mandaloon was, and then maybe he would have got a little bit first jump on them. But I think the talent and the pace is sort of – or the paces and who is the pace is sort of what I look at.
You mentioned the speed, and you mentioned Rock Your World. And for those that don't know, Joel Rosario, who's a rider now based in New York, he's considered one of the best judges of pace, whether that be on the lead or – coming from way back. How much of an added advantage is it having a jockey that is so good and adept at knowing how fast or slow the field is going, being on a speed horse.
Well, when you get to this level in a race like this, pretty much they're all they're not a whole lot separates them. But as you mentioned, he's very talented. Look, he's just a very talented jockey. But he does some he does well when he can get on the front end and control pace. And he's also very well on a closer when there is a lot of pace. So he's good in both facets of the game. I think the fact that he has some experience on the horse, even though it was a 6-furlong turf race, which was and the Derby where things just didn't go very well for him, I think that helps a little bit. And but I, you know, it's hard to, you know, when you look at the lineup of jockeys in this race, it's hard to say that one has a stronger advantage than the other.
So David, I'm going to, for levity only, I'm going to say that I heard there's a change of jockeys for this race coming up. And the star jockey just sat down that's going to be on one of the mounts, Cordero himself, the man. So which horse would best suit Cordero with his racing style?
Whichever one he wanted. If he told me he wanted to ride one of these horses, I would say, sorry, Mr. Whoever. I've got this guy on him. He's there's nobody. Look at and look who's behind
and,
him.
And next to him, this is a love fest. Next to him, we got George Velazquez. We got the two guys, the two rock stars from the '60s, '70s, '80s, and '90s.
I think any trainer in this race, if either of these guys said, "Hey, I can make 126," and I'm not so sure anymore, they'd say, "Let's go."
Okay. Well, so now that I got this is like a symphony. Now this is like amazing. So now that I've got, and I'm going to sort of half introduce all at the same time. They all showed up at the same time. We can't say no to these guys.
No.
They're more important than I am. But we got George Velazquez, who rode Aladar to 3 seconds, only losing by a total 2 lengths in the Triple Crown to Affirmed, and won already 2 out of 3 of the Triple Crown series, losing the third, the Belmont, on Pleasant Colony. And we got Cordero, who I understand he knows the game pretty well. So, George, welcome. And do you have any picks for today at all? Do you have any thoughts about for the Belmont?
There's a very very tough race. The 2, the 3, the 4, the 7, they all have a good chance to win. So. bet those 4 horses.
Well,
you have to,
and that's what we were saying. It's so well stacked together. So, if you had to race in this race, which horse would you want to be on? And then I'm going to ask Cordero the same thing. And then Grenning, I'll ask him, even though he and I are too heavy to be on any horses.
And Rumba.
You'd want to be Rumba.
Yeah.
And how about you? Which horse would you pick? I know which one you got to pick. Unfortunately.
Well, no, I'm going to be rooting for my Jack.
Right.
I will pick any of them 4 horses.
Right.
They all alive. You know, my McCarthy's horse was very impressive the other day.
Yeah.
Brad Cack's horse, you know, even so he lost a lot of ground in the Derby. He ran a good race.
Right.
Doug O'Neill's horse came running. You know, all them horses got a good chance. They got to have a trip. Everybody's worried about if they can go that far. They can go that far. They just don't go faster than the other ones. We don't breed to go in races to go a mile and a half all the time. And some of these horses will go farther later on. Some of these horses won't go no farther later on.
But well, I have a question. I want to ask these guys a question since there is an interesting jockey scenario in this race. So Flavian Pratt won the Preakness on Rumbauer. He won the Preakness on Rumbauer. He chose to ride Hot Rod Charlie in the Belmont. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, he probably was committed from the Belmont. When you commit for the Belmont, most of the time they want you for the Triple Crown. He probably, after he rode the Derby, the guy said, "We're going to pass the Preakness, we're going on the Belmont."
Right.
So he got lucky and picked up the winner for the Preakness. So he could not, you know, but both horses are very light.
But if you had, so now put your agent hat on. After the Preakness is run, how do you, do you start to, you guys are the the kings of spin. How do you, can you maneuver off that horse, or you really can't?
I don't think you can get rid of a call in a race like that.
Okay.
You know, even so, if he likes Mike McCarthy's horse, I don't think he have any choice because he probably was committed before.
Okay.
But I think they both horses got good chance. I hope for Doug O'Neill didn't run it by racing the Derby.
No, he did.
And resting for the Preakness is going to help him. And the other horse is just picking, Mike McCarthy's horse, he was very impressive. But you got to see if he can put up that race again, you know.
And just for the public knowledge, because we reach a vast audience, they know Cordero as a jockey, but he's also a jockey's agent, and his man, Manny Franco, is riding Overtook, the eighth position, a little bit of a long shot, but he came in third in the Peter Pan, and he's got a shot like any other horse, so that's the reason that you're in this game.
Well, he's a closer. He didn't close much on the Peter Pan because he was closer to the pace. He was not a fast pace, but he's a closer. And he's probably one of the ones that the distance is going to help him. I don't know if he's going to be able to catch up with them, but it's a hope. When a horse is a closer, it's like a fighter is a puncher. You always got a chance. They could always come the last minute and do it. You know.
They give it their all and they don't give up. And only because we're here, even though it's 2021, I got to ask you an interesting little question because we've got the connections here. We were here for, at least in theory, for Tis the Law winning the Belmont last year. It was a different Belmont. So, and that horse didn't quite do as well later into the race series. Do you have any comments about that? Did he just had already peaked out, or is there anything else going on that we should think about? Or
well, Tis the Law, after he won the Belmont, he went back and won the Travers.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, he got beat by the horse that became Horse of the Year in the Derby.
Right.
Got beat, you know, with excuse. He was not paced, and the other horse was a better horse that day. I don't think the races hurt him at all, you know. When he's equal for everybody, it doesn't make any difference to me, you know. It's like if it's a term that you have to wait 3 weeks in between or 4 weeks, as long as everybody does the same, it doesn't make any difference. But I believe now that we don't have horses like we used to have. We have horses that run the whole Triple Crown all the time. Same horses run on the Derby, went on the Preakness, and went to the Belmont. Now we got new customers all the time. So it's kind of very tough now. Because horses, for certain reason, they don't run as many times that closer to they did.
Right.
This before. Law didn't run as well at Churchill Downs as he ran on the other tracks. So his one loss as a two-year-old was at Churchill Downs on a sloppy track. And I didn't think he necessarily he didn't run a bad race in the Kentucky Derby. He basically chased, you know, last year's Kentucky Derby was almost the same as this year's Kentucky Derby. The horse got on the lead under John Velasquez and won the race. And the horse that chased basically from second throughout settled for second. But I don't think Tis the Law, you know, moved as well at Churchill Downs as he did, say, here at Belmont Park or even in the Travers, which was probably his best race. The performance he put on in the Travers at Saratoga was probably, you know, his he probably peaked that day.
Right, and we had discussed earlier in the show that sometimes a trainer has to be smart enough to know when it's time to basically back a horse up off and give him some time, because right. You can burn him out. You can't. An athlete just can't keep training and training and training and training and punching and punching.
The Breeders' Cup Classic was probably one race too many at that point, because as you said, he started in January of that year. I don't even think Authentic started that early, and obviously last year the schedules got all messed up, but by the time he was getting ready to get to the Classic coming off the Derby, he'd run the Travers, he'd run the Belmont, Florida Derby, Holy Bull, I think it was his first start. So he had a pretty elongated campaign, and when he wasn't running and when the whole COVID situation was going on and nobody knew what the schedules were, he had to keep training and training, because they could have said any minute, this is when the race is, this is when that, you know. The Belmont Stakes wasn't really scheduled. You know, we didn't know exactly when the Belmont was going to be until they allowed us to open up again in, you know, early June.
And I think Manny Franco ran a, you know, he steered a brilliant race to win the Belmont
yeah,
here.
Yeah,
he did superb, you know.
Manny did nothing wrong on the horse.
Right.
One thing I learned about this is when you have a rider that is not on top and he's riding a good horse, whenever he get beat, they're going to take him off. That's like a law over here, you know.
Wait, say that again? We got the Yale hoist coming.
That when you're riding a horse that is a good horse and he wins, you know the first time he gets beat, they're going to take him off. They're going to take you off. I spoke to Manny before the race, and I told him, our situation, that if you get beat, they're going to take you off. You take the best shot at it. Because if you ride him good and he don't win, they're going to take you off anyway. And if you ride him bad and he win, they won't take you off. So he was sitting on that fine line.
I want to offer both of our jockeys to input from their experience. In the jockey's room, you're riding with your friends every day of the year, guys you've got to know, and then a day the Triple Crown, the Belmont Stakes, comes around. All of a sudden, the guys you sit next to and are friends with, you're in the starting gate next to them for a huge race. What, how is the mentality different? Is like the friendship go out the window for that 2 minutes?
Well, I don't know how he feel about it, but the way I feel is, when I get on a horse and I hit the track, I ain't nobody's friend. If my mother is in there and I can get on the way, I will. If you're not nobody's friend when you're in the sport, say you're a pitcher, or you're a hitter, and your father is throwing a no-hitter, but you're going to let him throw a no-hitter for you, you're going to try harder. You don't want to be the one that they're going to point at you. I was your fault.
Well,
but I don't understand one thing about being removed from a horse, because I've been in the game since I was a very, very small kid. What I don't understand is the knocking the jockey when you want to take him off. Why do tattoo damage? Why take him off and then knock him?
Yeah, it's enough to just...
Yeah.
That's part of the business.
Yeah, the
that's what you have to take.
They didn't need to put out a press release to announce they were taking the guy off.
Everybody knew they were going to take him off, but they didn't have to blame it on him, but he got beat.
Yeah.
He followed instruction, and they got mad. I told him, I said, you know, me, when he came to a big race, I didn't listen to nobody. You know that. I don't care who was the trainer. When he came to a big race, special races like that, I'm going to take my best shot. Because like right. I said before, if you win, no matter how bad you ride, you're going to ride back. But if you don't win, you can ride the best race in your life, and they're going to take you off. I'm going to take my best shot. I don't want to go home sleeping and say, I should have done this or I should have done that. I'm going to take my best shot and ride the way I think I should have rode. And if he don't win, that's too bad.
Well, I don't want to embarrass Angel here, but I'm gonna tell a very quick one that I don't want to embarrass Angel, and I apologize to the audience. This is such a great opportunity; we can't let it go. But some guy's here removing the trash, and he's just not. I don't think he understands any language we're trying to communicate to him. Please don't do that. And he's more important to remove the trash than let us have this interview. But anyway, I remember an interview once with Cordero, who I consider to be sort of one of the masters of the one-liners. And one of the critics, one of the writers, Angel was known for being a very aggressive rider, and he would get physical and push people if they got too close to him and do whatever he had to do to win the race. So someone interviewed him and got a little bit too tight with him and said, Angel, let me ask you something. If your mother, do you remember this question? He turned to you and said, if your mother was on the horse next to you in a race, would you knock her off? Do you remember that? And I was so amazed. His answer was, my mother knows better than to race against me. Did I remember that?
Georgie and I, we compadres. We like brothers. We know each other since the 60s. I used to tell him all the time, you win all the races in Mama Park, hitting around with him, because you have no competition. I said, why don't you come to the big A? This is it. This is the Big Apple. When he came back here, I was sorry that I told him that. Because he was my biggest competitor here all year around. We was like brothers. We spent the whole after the races together, sometime in the morning. We went everywhere together. When the door opens, I don't know who he was. And I'm pretty sure he didn't know who I was. I just rode to win. And that was the case. After the race, a lot of time I followed him. He got mad at me, you know. And that was... Things happen in the race that you can't help it. When you're riding a horse, you don't get up from bed and planning that you're going to go and bother somebody. You just try to win.
Can we keep going?
We're going to take a break for our top of the hour.
Can we keep going?
I'll wait.
We're going to take a quick break for our top of the hour. Yeah. Angel Cordero, David Groening, Jorge Velasquez, they will be here when we get back.
I got a couple good questions.
You're listening to WRHU's coverage of the Belmont Stakes.
Right
now let's go live and on-site to our reporters at Belmont.
Welcome back to our coverage of the Belmont Stakes. We are in hour two of our special. I'm David Blixover, joined by Dr. Greg Barroza and a trio of fantastic guests from my left, jockey Angel Cordero, DRF handicapper David Groening, and to my right, another Hall of Famer, Jorge Velasquez. Dr. Barroza, you wanted to pick up this conversation once more.
Yeah, yeah. I hope our audience appreciates the lightness of the conversation. Generally, when you talk about racing, everyone gets down to statistics and timings and all this, but we're having more of a coffee chat here. And George Velazquez, who's almost like a brother to Angel Cordero and vice versa, said, challenged me to ask Angel. He said, once you beat him in a race, or what was it? What was it that you did, George?
No, he did.
But he stopped talking to you. What was that?
No,
over?
I stopped talking
to
him.
Oh, you stopped talking to him because he beat you in a race? And how long did that go on for? 30 years or something?
I think it was the Travers.
The Travers?
Yes.
Who were you running?
And I was coming on, and for sure I was going to win the race. But he took a pick, and he saw this horse coming. He probably didn't know that it was me. But then he started to come out, and he got me against the other horse, and stop me, dead cold.
So he wasn't afraid to bump you,
my
is what
horse
you're saying?
Come back and finish second, I think it was.
Right, right.
And I was ticked off. I was so mad at him. If I wasn't so close to him, I would have fought him.
Now, Angel, did you know it was George?
Yeah.
I
know.
He thought it was his mother.
No, I know I'm not going to change his mind now, because for all these years, he's still thinking the same way.
I want you to leave here as friends, you know.
We're never going to be here. I mean, I wrote Rod for the first time. I didn't know that he had the habits of pulled off or doing all the stuff that he did to me. I passed him about the 316 pole. I passed him. He was inside, and I passed by him. Okay? Now, it's a horse in front, and I got to him, and my horse started to, like, doing this. So I was looking for company, and I went like this. But I see the horse that way, like I see this way. But he was trained riding behind me. I could see him. So I came out to meet the other horse. And I battled him. And after the race, he said to me, if I claim foul, you come down. I didn't even know what I did. I said, go ahead and claim foul. But the inquiry was there already. So, you know, when I see the inquiry, I know I was in trouble.
Did you claim foul?
Did I?
Yeah.
Not only, okay, so they got the inquiry for a long time. And I looked at the race. I mean, if it would have been now, it would have never happened, nothing. So they take the number down. So now we got to go to the movie the next day. So I don't want to get dated inside a dog. So I said to him, give me a hand in the movie. You know, I mean, like, usually we do that. I said, you know, don't put the finger on me.
Can you believe this?
They already down. So he didn't talk to me. So we go to the movie. They show him the thing. They still know with friends. They got this flashlight and everything. He says, George, what do you have to say? He said, no comment. man. They hit me with a 10-day racing day. So he didn't want to talk to me. And I tried to tell him. I said, listen, I didn't do it on purpose. Yeah. I did went out. I don't deny it. But I looked at it and I went out. But he was a very clean rider. And I tried to make it, when he came to New York, I tried to make it the way it should have been. Because he used to have me behind horses, and he looked at me and said, you need out? And I said, yeah, and he let me out. Said, he had that much confidence that he could let me out and beat me. But when he was in trouble and he had me for out, one day I said, are you alive? He said, yes. I ain't open. That's the thing that I did to him more than what I did in Saratoga, and he never got mad at me. I used to shit about you better, and he come back and yell at you, and you didn't even listen. But I told him, I said, George, man, when that door opened, I don't hear nothing, man. I just go for it, you know. And it's just something that happens when you are an athlete and you playing a sport with somebody that you know is as good as you or better than you. You're going to do your best no matter what.
Right.
And it's you ride harder when somebody that you know that is good than when somebody that is just a jockey. But I rode hard with him. And I'm pretty sure he wrote hard. Not as hard as I wrote for him, because he was very clean. I used to say, why don't you battle me? This way I feel better, you know. That's when I battle you, I don't feel that bad.
Well, I'm glad to see the respect stayed there. It's, you know, just this week they played the Tyson movie, Part 2, and it was amazing. He came to a revelation on the Oprah show, and he was hugging Evander Holyfield. And they gave each other respect, and they said, you know, it's... Tyson reverted back to his Bronxville days. It was, Brownsville days. It wasn't any longer the Tyson, the fighter. He just was getting beat, and he didn't know how to deal with it. So But, you know, you're both at that level. You're both the Hall of Famers and you're both superstars. I can't let you guys go without asking this question, and I don't mean to put you on the spot. I apologize even for asking the question, but I just want to get a minute or two from each of you, what your thoughts, the latest controversy concerning the medication issues, drugs, Baffert's. You know, we all, I think, are hoping that he is clean and that things work out to his benefit, because we'd like to see the sport and the integrity maintained, but I think he's got himself kind of boxed in a corner, and I think we all want the sport to survive forever. Do you, anyone have any thoughts about, has it changed the field, the our industry forever? Is it just temporary? Is it something that we're going to get through? I mean,
well, I think the industry,
and you got to realize too, the last part is that because the industry is not unilaterally combined, the government's going to take over in 2022. With the drug testing and all that, it's not going to be. Each state has its own rules and regulations. So,
well, that's a much needed change. Racing had all the time in the world to try and get itself together without federal intervention, and it didn't happen. And so now they are going to. There's going to be federal oversight and uniform rules, which is much needed. I mean, we're in New York here, and the rules to race in New York are different than if you ran a race in Monmouth Park in Jersey or in Delaware Park in Delaware or parks in Pennsylvania or Laurel, the rules are all different in five states. It's not supposed to be that way. It shouldn't be this hard. So from that standpoint, I think the federal oversight will be good. From the Baffert situation, I think he is in a precarious position now with Churchill Downs basically banning him from racing there for 2 years, means he can't participate in two Kentucky Derbies. His owners, the reason he gets so many horses is because he's won the Derby six times, and with a seventh, you know, hanging in the balance, his owners now are going to have to make some really hard decisions. Do we stay with Bob and forego races like the Derby, or do we have to say, Bob, sorry, we want to win the Derby too, and we have to go somewhere else? We'll see how well his attorneys can do for him, but I don't know that he's going to get, you know. Churchill Downs is reacting to messing with the Kentucky Derby. That's their prized possession. And somebody messed with it, and they took retaliation. And I don't know that that's going to get overturned. But as far as the industry goes, I think the industry will survive.
Do you have any thoughts or comments? Or
I just feel bad that these situations are coming now, you know, because he's a real good trainer. He's been very good to the sport. He aports a lot. Triple Crown races, and he's on a bad spot. I just hope everything worked out good for him.
Well, when you do something wrong, you got to be punished. Just when, like, for example, when you were riding and you get to bother somebody in the stretch in the last 16 of a mile, you have to get suspended. You got to take whatever is coming to you because you did the wrong thing. So I feel bad about it. Like you say, he's one of the greatest, and his record speaks for himself. So, you know, but somehow you're going to get cut, and you're going to get punished.
Well, from a little bit of a veterinary perspective, Baffert certainly is an amazing trainer, amazing conditioner. You can't take someone that's not any animal or person that's not an athlete, not at the top level, and do the things he did. As far as any advantages by some medication or by some rule breaking, which everyone has done at some point in their career, you know, everyone's taking advantage to win. And when they're all at that same level, like you said, when you're up against someone that's equal to you, or you're up in a field of horses that are all equal to you, everyone takes the most advantage they can. From a veterinary perspective, without putting my foot in my mouth, there's issues to keep these horses sound, and people are doing all sorts of things, and some of them are acceptable and some of them aren't acceptable, and some are not acceptable but not obvious, you know. So I just hope that he can clear himself, and oh my God, this guy's here again. We may have to take a break here, only because we've got some guy here. It's very important that they move some equipment right at where the studio is.
All right, yeah, we are going to take another break, but we'd like to thank our jockeys and handicapper David Gurning for joining us this morning. When we come back, Dr. Burrows and I will continue talking horses on the Thursday before Belmont. Hello.
You're listening to WRHU's coverage of the Belmont Stakes, the third race in the Triple Crown and the biggest race and home of some of the most memorable events in horse racing history.
Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish 25 lengths in front.
Now let's go live and on-site to our reporters at Belmont.
Welcome back to beautiful Belmont Park. Once again, I am David Blicksilver, joined by Dr. Greg Burrows of the Horse Doc. We're still talking horses here, and jockey George Velasquez has been kind enough to stick around, even though our other two guests have departed. And I suppose, Dr. Burrows, now that the ice has been broken, we'll talk about the Bob Baffert situation just a little bit.
Okay. Before we go on, though, I wanted to thank Angel specifically. He's not here, but did a big favor by coming out. And had to leave, wished he could stay longer, but has other obligations. It's, as we tried to explain to the audience, these people are all training horses and running and making connections. And he's a jockey's agent. He's very active right now, and he's busy making sure he's got mounts for his man, Manny Franco, who's going to be riding Overtook in the Belmont Stakes. And then Dave Grenning is busy. He's talking to us about this one race at Belmont Stakes, but he knows every race today. He'll know every race tomorrow, and he knows the stats on all these horses. He's like a walking encyclopedia. I can't even keep up with him. So he's in a different stratosphere. But and also I want to thank our guests that stayed with us. George Velasquez is I consider a very quiet, gentle superstar. I mean, he just had back surgery at the end of March, and he's not healed up, and he decided to do us a favor and come in and give us some of his time. We appreciate that. He's one of the rare, I don't mean senior meaning you're old. You're not old, George, because you and I are not far apart, but you're one of the senior elder statesmen, meaning you've been here for 40, 50 years.
Whatever.
Well, no, and I now's the time for me to bring up something before we get into the Baffert thing, because we can go on for that for the next 5 hours, but I had a personal nostalgic moment when I came in Thursday to organize some of this and ask people if they would come on to the show. And I walked into a barn, and you're going to know what I said. Do you remember Barn 48? That was Johnny Campo's barn. And I walked in there, and I don't think I ever told you this. We've spoken about many things many times, but that's where I started 50 years ago.
Wow.
I walked the entire Belmont Park because I just knew that I wanted to be involved with horses. And I remember as a young kid driving by in a car and my folks saying, there's Belmont Park, where they race horses there. I said, I'm going to work there one day. True story.
Really?
And then when I finally got old enough, I came in. And back in that era, in the 70s at least, many of the grooms and the hot walkers and people that came from the farms from Kentucky.
Right.
Many of them were second or third generation. They were the sons of, et cetera. There was very few women. And so it was tough for a little skinny white kid that never handled a horse to get a job, you know? So, I was raised to always tell the truth and do the right thing, and I walked around every one of the barns, and I told everyone, I really want to learn. I know I belong here and all this. And they kept saying, well, you need experience. These are different horses than what you're used to. So I passed, and the last barn I came to, the very last barn, if I didn't score in this barn, was Johnny Campos. And I walked in, and I overheard him talking to Gene, his foreman at the time. And he said, Gene, where's that damn hot walker? And for the crowd that doesn't understand, you pay young kids or you pay someone almost nothing, peanuts, to just take the horses that just exercised. You have to know how to handle a horse, though. And you walk them around, and the groom generally bathes them after a workout, and they're all hot and sweaty, and then you cool them down or they'll get sick. And that's what a hot walker does. All you do is walk horses all day. So I said, you know, where's that damn hot walker? He said, we're down a man, and we really need a hot walker badly. So it's like, you know, that expression, God helps those that help themselves. This was my religious moment. God was giving me permission to say whatever I had to say to get that job. So I walked in, and I said, Mr. Campo, I said, I'm a little bit upset. I've been working down there for Sanford Stud, which was a big name outfit at the time. And I said, I've been there for a while, and it's time for me to change. Do you have anything here? And he says, what could you do, kid? And I said, I could walk hots. And he says, all right. He says, hand that kid this horse. It just got off. And I never handled a thoroughbred in my life, you know? And you know what they could be. They're like, yes, an explosion waiting to happen.
Right.
So I walked around the barn, got towards the end by Elmont Avenue, whatever that is, and the horse exploded because the car backfired. And all of a sudden the horse went up on his two legs, and I just worked with him because, quite frankly, that stuff to me became natural. I was good at all that, and that's why I did what I did for a living. And I came around, and I heard Johnny turn to his friend Gene, and he says, "That kid knows how to handle a horse." I didn't correct him. And so it's interesting, but also you rode a lot of horses for Johnny, and you rode Pleasant Colony, won the...
I have lots of fun with him.
Yeah.
He was, besides being a very, very good trainer, he was funny. Very funny guy. He makes you laugh and everything else. It's amazing. We got lucky together. I won a lot of races for Johnny. I miss him.
He was a good man. And you know, whatever I say about him, I mean respectfully. I don't mean it disrespectfully, but he was a street guy. He was not highly educated. He even at one point when it looked like he was going to win the Triple Crown on Pleasant Colony, gave an interview to the Sports Network. At that time, maybe there's only four or five stations. That's before some of my colleagues here. Now we have like hundreds. There was like four or five major networks, and that was it. And they asked him about being a trainer there. He says, "Listen," he says, "I was selling newspapers on the street corner till I got into this horse racing game. And if it hadn't come along, I'd still be selling newspapers on the street corner." That's the way he was.
Yeah.
And when I came back as a veterinarian to Long Island years later, and I gave a seminar out in Huntington at the high school auditorium across the street from my place, he was the only trainer. He made a point of showing up to my lecture. And
really?
Yeah, it was a big deal. He was a good guy. And he was a great horseman. And didn't he was groomed by Niloy, I guess?
Right, yes.
Niloy, who trained for the Phippses and owned the racetrack.
That's right.
And so when Niloy retired or something like that, or maybe he passed away, I don't know the details. I hadn't planned on telling you the story, but it just seems appropriate. But the Phippses said, "Who are we going to get to be your replacement for Niloy?" And Niloy said, "If anything happens to me, Johnny Campbell's the man. He's been my assistant. He knows the horses. He's great. The only problem was he wasn't polished. You know, he street talk and foul language and whatever it took." So they hired him for a short period of time, but one condition, that he go to one of these grooming schools where he learns proper English and he learns how to handle himself and do all this kind of stuff, because he never had that experience. So they sent him to the school, and he flunked out. The reason he flunked out, they said, "We can't keep him here any longer. He's making the other guys worse." But that was Johnny, and he knew the horses. He was a lot of the people that don't understand this world don't realize that a lot of people on the backside of the track, this is their avocation, and they're excellent at it. They're like mechanics with the horses and with everything involved in the business. It doesn't mean that they're the most highly educated people from an academic perspective. And it's an interesting thing to recognize. It's a trade. Right, George?
Yes. He was great, no? He was great. I remember, riding different horses for him and come back after the race and I say, "John, this horse is not traveling too good." He says, okay. He used to talk real fast, like, okay. You watch him next time. So next time, the horse is like sound, and he wins. Every time I say something to him, like to improve the horses, he was right there. Blinkers on, and John, he logs in a little bit, put the bird on, and he did everything possible to win a race. Great. He was amazing.
Yeah, and so tell me, you rode Pleasant Colony, and you won the Derby, you won the Preakness, and then you came up to the Belmont, and the horse just didn't fire.
Well, when I won the Derby, coming from way, way back, I think it was about 23 horse field, and I was, the beginning was like 17 all the way back there. So I came charging and turning for home. I say, "I'm a winner because I know what I have under me." So he's finishing strong, very strong. And we pass the wire, we won. I want to win that race so bad that pass the race, pass the wire, and I'm like, man, I pull up. I won the Derby. And when I'm getting closer to the stands, coming back, the people clapping and all that, and man, tears started to come out. You know, like, oh, man, I got so emotional. So I had to compose myself and say, come on, man, stop. You're on TV right now. So I got myself together, and I came back, and Gianni was the happiest guy on earth. So now we won that one. We win the Preakness. Coming to the Belmont, mile and a half, that's strictly his distance for my horse. What happened? They went walking. They went swimming with George Martins. He rode a good race, though. He slowed down the pace so much. They went like 25, 52 for a half, and walking. So at the 3-8 pole, when I made my move, I was getting to them, but they was going so slow that when they hit the quarter pole, they took off running again. And I was third. And the race that I thought that I was a real big cinch, I finished third. He was so good, that horse, that he was so good that he still, with that bad pace, he come on at the end, finished third. And, of course, Janet was going to be disappointed, sort of myself. And, you know, but we have many good days, many good races to talk about it.
Can you capsulize in just 3 minutes, basically? Like me, you wanted, no one trained you to be a jockey. It just happened.
It was like fate.
What happened?
Yes. I grew up in a little town in Panama. It's called Chepo, Chepo. And I had no right to become a jockey. We did have a farm horse. It was totally different. So there was a kid that was living about two houses down from my house. I didn't even know that he was riding. So he came to the town with a pony, and he put the saddle on, and he gave us a bunch of kids an exhibition, like 200 meters. And when I passed by me like that, something went inside of me. I said, I know I can do that. I know I can do it. So that was it. Now, at the time I was about 14 years old, going to 15, and I told my mother. Well, after he passed by me, and I said, well, I know I can do it, I met him and I met his daddy. And I told Cesar, his daddy was Cesar Bosquez. I said, Senor Cesar, I like what I saw in your son. I want to become a jockey. He said, okay, so you have to come to the city and we'll help you out. So I told my mother. I said, I'm leaving, I want to go, I want to become a jockey. And my mother like, what are you talking about? Now that you are older enough to help us over here, now you want to leave?
Yeah.
She says, okay, leave, but don't you ever come back here. And I'm like, ooh, hold back. I can't do that. What if I don't make it? 2-3 weeks went by. I keep thinking about becoming a jockey. So I went back to her. This time she's cooking lunch.
Right.
And I'm all over her again. Mom, I want to leave. I want to become a jockey. I want to. And she was so busy. She grabbed one of those Quaker Oaks cans that was empty. She grabbed and bang, she hit me over the head. I forgot about becoming a jockey again for 2-3 months. But I never give up. I come back again. Mom, I want to leave. She says, I'll tell you what. You want to leave? Okay, you leave. You go to the city.
I don't want you to be a jockey. You go and work for your daddy. You live with your daddy and you work for your daddy. My daddy was a butcher at the time. So I agree with her, but I had in the back of my mind to become a jockey. So I call my daddy and she said, well, come and get me. And so I didn't say anything that I want to become a jockey to my daddy. So he picked me up. We come to the city. In about 2 weeks, cutting meat and selling to the people in public, and I learned how to do everything in 2 weeks. Now, his right-hand man that he had, he fired him because I'm there. And, of course, he's not going to pay me like he paid the other one. So he left, the kid left, and I'm doing everything. Now, all of a sudden, who comes to the bench to buy me meat? Cesar Bosquez. Not the jockey, the son. I mean, the daddy. He came and asked him, do you remember me? He said, yes, of course. I told you that I want to be a jockey. And you told me you was going to help me. He said, okay, anytime you're ready, I'll take you to the racetrack. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Right now, can you take me now? He says, yes, I'll take you. It was about 2 in the afternoon.
So I'm not going to cut you off because we got to keep moving here, but that's basically what started your career.
Yeah, definitely.
And you left the meat industry to become a jockey.
He took me to the track. He introduced me to one of the top trainers, and that was it. Then I come back and told my daddy, I'm going to learn how to become a jockey, so no more meat.
It was in your blood, and I have to say, for people that don't understand the way things work sort of around here, is that this is like its own little community. And yes. People come in, and some of them never leave. I don't know if that's good or bad, but they come in, and they sort of never leave.
Yes,
that's the way life is. Back on the Baffert deal, if we could, just for a few minutes. So your belief is that if he broke the rules, he's got to pay the price. It's as simple as that.
Well, eventually you're going to get caught if you're doing something that right. you're not supposed to. I feel sorry for the animals, for
right.
the horses.
Right.
But he's trying to win. He wants to win.
No
so
matter what.
Like Angel. He wants to win, so he do anything to win.
Right.
So if you do something wrong, you got to pay the price. And pay the price and come back and keep doing what you doing. You know. I feel sorry for him because it's 2 years is a long time. And I remember when I was riding and I got suspended for 7 days. And those days were 7 days. It was like I was lost. I didn't know what to do, where to go, anything else, you know. And so it's hard to be out of the business that you know how to do and you love to do.
Right.
You know?
What's it like as a jockey, though? As either another horse in the race or the jockey on that horse, like the mentally the jockey that finished second, I believe Florent Giroux on Brad Cox's horse. You know, you think 2 years ago when Flavien Prat wins by disqualification and now maybe he wins this year by disqualification, as a jockey you want to win the Derby by being the first horse across the line, not being the horse that gets put up. You think
right.
mentally
right.
that's a negative effect?
Yes, of course, because you want to leave that moment yourself passing the wire in front. It's okay. They give it to you. You're going to get the money. You're going to get, you know.
You don't get the photo. You don't get
the
experience in the winner's circle
yeah,
after the race.
It's totally different. It's totally
We're going to throw it to another break here on our Belmont Stakes morning show coverage on WRHU 88.7 FM. When we come back, Dr. Barroza and myself will continue the conversation of Talking Horses.
You're listening to WRHU's coverage of the Belmont Stakes.
The right
now let's go live and on-site to our reporters at Belmont.
Can do. This guy says the horse can do.
Welcome back to beautiful Belmont Park. It's a little less beautiful today as the rain starts to pick up again. But nonetheless, I'm David Blixover, joined
by Dr. Greg Barroza, the horse doc himself. We're still talking horses, and our jockey, George Velasquez, is still with us across the table. And as we shift gears a little bit to a little more of a delicate subject, I will pick the brain of the veterinarian sitting next to me, who I'm hoping can give us a little bit of insight. When people hear testing, horse players and horse owners, trainers, people around the track know that horses are tested before and after a race. But the general public may not have as good of an idea of the testing process and also what a split sample test is.
Okay, so the question is,
would you like to elaborate on the testing process and explain what a split sample is to our listeners?
Okay, well, let me start like you started with the intro about the testing process. Every one of these horses that comes in here is eligible to be tested. They can pull any horse they want. It's generally the first, at least the winner, sometimes the second, third horse. Or it could also be if they decide that a particular horse that was favored comes in last, they might say something doesn't seem right here. We want to test for that reason and figure out what's going on. So the testing is varied. It can be anything from a swab to pick up saliva and look for medications, which you have to understand, we're talking now Triple Crown stuff here, so it's much more under a microscope than the everyday racing that goes on. And the cost of testing and all the personnel. So they can do swabs. It can also take urine. And supposedly the most decisive could be blood. So blood is a test. So when they say they take a split sample, blood is drawn, and they take enough blood. It's only a small vial. It doesn't take much to test. But they take enough blood that they could have at least a sample they can freeze and put away. So if a positive test appears, then they still have more of the blood, and they could send it out at the request of whoever's the racing authority to an independent lab. Generally, and this is where it gets funky, because every racetrack in every state has its own set of rules. But for the most part, they're close to uniform, but they're not uniform. So as I understand, in Baffert's situation, he and his attorney were entitled to pick the lab that they wanted to send it to. Now, my information, I'm not like an expert on all this, but I know what I read, and I'm quoting some of the stuff that I picked out of the New York Times, but they chose to send it to the lab in California, which Baffert is from California, so anyway, they felt more comfortable. And so now they have the first sample from Kentucky. We're on track, or whoever does the testing for them or the state said it's positive. Then they get to send a sample, and they sent it to California. Now, there's a lot of discussion about positive. What's a positive? They say the amounts are so microscopic, no one could even find them. Well, that's not 100% true, because medication, sometimes all we need to give is 3 cc's, 3 milliliters of a medication into a horse's whole bloodstream. It's in very microscopic amounts. It doesn't take much. I mean, when you get anesthetized, it doesn't take much to knock you out. So it's sometimes small particles can do amazing things. But, you know, I would never convict anyone on a problem without having all the evidence. So I'm not here to set up a case for or against Baffert or anyone else that gets in these problems. And the other thing that I want to mention is that in horse racing, every one of these trainers at some point runs into something. George just told you as a jockey he was set down for 7 days. They all run into something. They don't intentionally want to do it. There's hardly a person alive that never got a speeding ticket, even if you weren't intending on speeding. It's just like you're daydreaming or the music's going, you're having a good day, and all of a sudden you see lights flash and you go, oh, you know, I did it. And you could swear up and down you didn't do it, but the guy says, I just clocked you. Especially gets worse if he's got radar or LIDAR or whatever, and now you're in trouble. And I want the public to realize that Baffert is in much higher risk for this happening to him than any other trainer, because he trains more horses than anyone else.
Right.
So if you're on the road and you have a commercial fleet and you have 200 cars, you got a greater chance of one of the cars getting a ticket than you just driving someplace and getting a ticket on your own, right?
Right.
So that can happen. So now we got the blood. Now we take the blood, and we get a positive. Now we get the second test, and that's a positive. So I understand through articles in the New York Times that they've requested a third testing now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they're going to say, I don't know who they're sending. That's the latest I heard, but I don't know the answer to that. And also, now the lawyers get involved. Now there becomes a defense team. And they're claiming that they asked Kentucky not only to do blood, but to send the urine, and also, but they never did that. Now, what would you find in the urine? Sometimes it's things called metabolites in the urine. They're trying to figure out whether it was this antifungal cream that went on the horse that caused the issue, and they're looking for ways to prove that that's what it was. They may come up with one, they may not. But they're also looking to extend the legal process, because in so doing, there's, if anything isn't done by the book, each step of the way, the whole thing could be thrown out, right?
Right.
Right.
So I can't blame him for taking that strategy. Where it goes, I don't know. I really don't know.
And just to clarify, the drug in question is not the antifungal cream you mentioned, because the horse was being treated for dermatitis. It's something that they believed that was in the contents of the cream by the name betamethasone, which
right.
is an anti-inflammatory steroid type drug.
Right.
Which, I'm going to let you finish my sentence, is particularly used for horses that...
Well, betamethasone primarily in a track environment is used to inject a joint. But it also was claimed to be in this cream. But just being a strategist and not trying to build a case against Baffert, I mean, I hope the guy gets out and becomes a poster child for doing things right, but that's not looking that promising right now. But betamethasone is generally as a joint injection or something along those lines. And, you know, to make things worse, he's already had so many infractions, and he's already been given a free pass because of his status, because he's a superstar. They let him go. So it'd be like in George's prime or Angel's prime, if they were riding and one of them fouled the other one, they go, well, we can't call a foul on Angel, or we can't call a foul on George. You know, but if one of the other newer apprentice jockeys does it, we got to call a foul on him. That's prejudicial, right? You can't do that. So the same thing here. You can only excuse someone so many times for doing something and saying, okay, we understand there's a problem here. Okay, we understand there's an exception to the rule. But there can't be an unlimited number of exceptions to the rule. And he's been put on notice. He actually hired a veterinarian to be in the barn to make sure any medication came and left that barn was okay. So in theory, he did that to protect himself. And still, this medication showed up after the fact. Mm. But the bigger questions are, can you put a cream on that has a little bit of betamethasone, and is it going to be absorbed enough that it ends up in the bloodstream and then comes up with a positive? That's going to be a $64,000 question, okay?
Yeah.
And now they're asking for a third sample. So we'll see where it all goes. And then Dave Grenning said that basically, besides Kentucky now suspending Baffert for 2 years for what happened, he says New York has banned him indefinitely.
Really?
That's what he said. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just telling you what Dave Grenning told me, who's on top of everything, and it just came out. So there'll be different jurisdictions, like California has its own jurisdiction in every state. So he'll be okay to train horses in different states, but some of the big states have already joined and said he can't. Now, what's going to be very interesting is that this is going to become, I believe, a major story for several years, only because the federal government, after many years of our industry not coming together with one person to answer to, like in the NBA or any one of the organizations, there's no one person that manages thoroughbred racing in the country. And so the federal government is taking over, and they're going to do the drug testing or oversee it. So how are they going to allow this new commission, allow each state to have its own rules and regulations, say that it's okay for Baffert to race in California, but he can't race in New York or Kentucky? And it's going to be very difficult, and I think it's going to turn into legal battles.
Well, we are seeing some of those rule changes become a little more universal. Like, for example, Lasix, they're no longer using them on younger horses. They're no longer using them on stakes horses, I believe, up to 48 hours before a race in New York. And again, I'll pick your brain as a veterinarian for our listeners who don't know what I'm saying when I say Lasix. Lasix is a drug that is administered to a horse before the race. And again, you can finish my sentence, that basically helps the horse in which way?
Well, Lasix was brought in, I think, to racing. And don't hold me to these facts and figures. I didn't prepare to come give a seminar on this, but I think it was around the 70s or so that people started using Lasix for bleeders. What a bleeder is, a horse races so hard that he ruptures minor capillaries inside his lungs, and then blood comes up and actually gurgles and cuts off some of his air. So it came across as a major drug for that in the early days. But then from that, next, some people started realizing that the horses that were allowed to take this medication seemed to perform better. They raced better. So they considered it an enhancer. But the enhancer was, the other properties, it's a diuretic. It causes the reduction of fluid volume. The horses urinate before the race, but in so doing, they've just knocked their weight down. So they're racing with less weight, in theory. So, and then also, it kind of messes with your drug testing, because you think there's an unlimited number of tests that can test every microscopic amount of everything out there without confusing the testing itself. So it sort of screws with that. So they're finding some things were able to slide by testing because the horses were on Lasix. So it started off, and New York was one of the last, the give outs. And it was back in my era that I was actually very openly against introducing Lasix in New York. But I was a solo voice. Yeah. Because I think it's hard to administrate that. You should either have a no drug policy, everyone's clean. Because when you say, well, you can have only so many picograms of this, and you can only have so many picograms of this, and bute, and you know, on and on and on, every medication, and there's a full list of these things. You need to, it would be very difficult for a veterinarian at the track to keep moving from state to state and practicing, because every state has a different set of what's allowed and what isn't allowed. So that's where we get into the controversy. And now, like you said, there was, a lot of people don't realize they don't use Lasix. They didn't use any of the two-year-olds at race to get ready, as that three-year-old is eligible for this Triple Crown Series, could not be in a race with Lasix. So it's true performance. And New York was one of the holdouts, but there was a lot of pressure because the horses that were coming out of Kentucky and California, places where Lasix were allowed, they come here to the Belmont Stakes, where it wasn't allowed in the early years, and they wouldn't win. The horses that were doing super on the other tracks, and they said, you know, we better make this uniform because our horses can't win in New York. That's why there's no Triple Crown winners. So there was a lot of pressure. First, we're going to allow it only for the older stakes horses, not the youngsters. Well, you pick up a program from a couple years ago, and there's Lasix every horse. The only ones that don't have Lasix are at a disadvantage. Right. So that became another issue. So I don't know. It's a big quagmire, and we'll see where it goes. But I believe, just like it was in 1968, Dancer's Image got nailed for having butazolidone, an anti-inflammatory. And that turned into a 4 to 5 year court battle with legal battles back and forth with couldn't race here, was allowed back to race, won the case, lost the case. But it finally resolved where no case, you know, so he lost. And the veterinarian who supposedly administered it was taken out of our association. Yeah, so this isn't new to racing. The question is, how much tolerance is there? And unfortunately, I think that as when you let the federal government get involved in administrating and dictating, it's not necessarily a great thing. It doesn't make it easier. It makes it worse. So I don't know where it's going. I hope. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Barroza, we appreciate your insight as an expert in this industry as far as whether or not Baffert, just analyzing the drugs and the Lasix and all that. We thank George Velasquez also for joining us, and I'd like to get his take one more time, as I've been looking at the questions on our social media feed. One of them is, who are we betting? And at the end of the day... We want to get everyone's opinion. Eight horses. I guess there can be more than one winner. There's never been more than one winner in the Belmont before. That's actually one of our questions, too. There's never been a dead heat in the Belmont. But when you look at the field of eight, Todd Pletcher, who's the local trainer here, he's got three horses. He knows how to win this race. On the outside, number eight overtook for Manny Franco. And Todd Pletcher, one of the longer shots in the race, and the owners, Mike Rapoli Stable, he's another local person from the New York area, he always likes to have a horse running in the Belmont Stakes. Pletcher's other horse, Note Agenda, breaking from the sixth post. Arad Ortiz rode that horse in the Kentucky Derby. They broke from the dreaded one post. Didn't run a bad race, all things considered. Now he comes to New York, too. And then Pletcher's third horse, which breaks from the rail this time, Bourbonic, with Kendrick Carmouche, had that thrilling win at Aqueduct back in April in the Wood Memorial at 72-1. So Pletcher knows how to bring in winners, but there's plenty of live horses in this race. Yes. So I'll go to George first. What are you thinking?
I really like the three horse, Ron Bauer.
Any
If I was riding, I would love to be on him.
And you think because of his race in the Preakness that his style will suit the extra distance?
Yes, exactly. I believe he's strictly a mile and a half horse.
And he has a Hall of Fame jockey to do it.
Yes, right. And I'm sure that now they're not going to go 25-52. So he'd be coming on.
Dr. Barroza?
I'm going just because with Doug O'Neill's horse, Hot Rod Charlie. I think I first met Doug O'Neill back in 2012 here when he had I'll Have Another. Actually, long story there we don't have time for, but I think he's a good trainer. I think he's got a hot horse. I think that he's given his horse enough time off to get ready for this big race, and he knows what he's in store for, and I think he's hungry for it. And each one of these big races cumulatively takes a touch out of that horse. It's tough. So I'm going with Doug O'Neill just because I like Doug O'Neill and I like the horse, and I think that all these horses we're discussing, any one of them, I've got a little cheat sheet here, any one of four or five of them could easily do it, and I think that's why it's going to be a stupendous race.
I know you said it earlier, we'd love to be able to go back and forth about our disagreements, but I can't disagree with you here. I think it's Hot Rod Charlie. I think, look at that horse's race in the Kentucky Derby. He was competitive. He did beat Essential Quality, even though he wasn't the winner. He finished ahead of Essential Quality as far as finishing third and fourth. Whether that becomes second and third, we'll know soon enough. But I really like that Flavian Pratt committed to Hot Rod Charlie to ride in the Kentucky Derby. He gets back on the horse here in the Belmont Stakes. He knows the horse. I do see George Velasquez's point to Rumbauer. Horse has the nice distance, come from off the pace, and he seemed to be finishing with a lot of run in the Preakness. Nobody knows this track better than John Velasquez. So I think we will see a very competitive race. I would be very surprised if a horse wins by more than maybe 2-3 lengths.
All right.
I'm going to jump in. I rarely do this. I'm lucky to pick a winner, but I'm going to give you my five picks in an order. I don't know why. Just I'm going to pick Hot Rod Charlie first, which is the four horse. I'm going to pick Rumbauer second, George's horse. He's number three in the gate. My third is going to be the Essential Quality horse, number two, which is Brad Cox's that came fourth in the Kentucky Derby, but up to then had five straight wins. Then I'm going to pick Pletcher's horse, Known Agenda, the sixth horse, because even though he's only ninth in the Kentucky Derby, I think that Todd knows his track better than anyone, and Arad Ortiz is as hot as they come right now. And then I'm going to pick Rock Your World as my fifth, the number seven horse. And I just have an emotional good wish for all of them. They have a safe trip, and I always wish Manny Franco and Angel Cordero, the best on the eight horse Overtook. We'll see how he does. Maybe he'll pop up and win one for Todd.
We always wish for a safe trip for our horses and riders. We're excited to have the fans back this weekend.
Yes,
12,000 strong. They'll be cheering. Their voices will be loud. The bets will be made. And it should be a very fun weekend here. That will do it for our 2021 coverage of the Belmont Stakes. George Velasquez sat with us for the second hour of the show. We thank him very much for his time on a very busy weekend. I'm alongside Dr. Greg Barroza, the horse doc himself. We've been talking horses for 2 hours, and I know we've said it before, and we can't say it enough. It sure is great to see the big sandy dirt track as our
big
ground in front of us.
A big thank you, George. You're the man. You're the man.
And too bad that we are in this kind of position, like the pandemic.
because in any other year, it would be 100,000 people here.
Yes.
In Belmont Day.
We wish you the best and speedy healing and recovery on your back surgery. You're the man.
Thank you very much.
For George Velasquez, Dr. Greg Rosa, I'm David Blixover. You've been listening to the WRHU coverage of the 2021 Belmont Stakes on 88.7 FM.